Hello, welcome to Wheat from the Chaff. I'm Finlow Costain, the chief editor of 8.9.com.
And I'm Phil Carson, the head of UK policy for the Nature Friendly Farming Network.
And as usual, we're going to dissect a few of the stories that have been on 8.9 over the last couple of weeks. And then later in the programme, we're going to be meeting Rob York, who is otherwise known on social media as @BlackGull. He is a self-proclaimed environmental diplomat, known for his short vlogs on Twitter in particular. And Phil, before we go any further, I suspect that we ought to just kind of mention that there may be a little bit of programme disruption, which is possibly not quite the right way of putting it, over the next few weeks. And I wonder if you can tell us why.
Yes, well, disruption might be the term to use after the event, potentially, Finlow. Yes, so we may be limiting the number of podcasts that we put out in the future, as I'm expecting, well, not me myself, but my first child, in any time over the next couple of weeks. So yeah, on red alert for a new arrival and everything that that brings as well. So yeah, we might have a bit of a disrupted agenda or schedule after that.
Absolutely. And Phil, you've been telling me quite confidently that you'll be able to do a programme every 2 weeks, which sounds fantastic. But I tell you, with my first kid, he didn't sleep for the first 2 years, and even doing a programme every 2 weeks would have been difficult. So we'll just have to take it as it comes.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of knowing looks and almost an expression of kind of, yeah, you're being very naive with what you're planning to do. So we'll see. I'm going in with
you may be lucky.
Yeah, it could be. I'm going in with blissful ignorance and making plans, but being prepared to change them as well.
Fantastic. Well, best of luck to both of you for that. And anyway, first up today, we have a big story. It's class action style claim takes on chicken giant, and it really is a kind of a Jack and the Beanstalk story here, with a legal claim potentially worth hundreds of millions of pounds, which has been launched by law firm Lee Day in a bid to compensate thousands of people living on the River Wye in the Wye catchment, likely to have been affected by a major degradation of the River Wye and its tributaries in recent years. And the claim is going to be brought against Avara Foods Limited, alleging that industrial-scale chicken farming in the River Wye catchment is polluting the River Wye and surrounding land. And I guess, you know, let's go into the allegation. It's that as a result of a massively expanded chicken industry in the Wye catchment, phosphorus pollution in particular associated with chicken feces is effectively killing the river. And this isn't particularly news. We've known about this for several years. And this legal action is coming at the point at which there has been a remarkable failure by statutory bodies like the Environment Agency and government to actually arrest and address this decline. And Avara is in the frame specifically because, according to Lee Day, it's responsible for 80% of the birds living in that catchment. And just to give us some context, they reckon that there's an estimated 23 million chickens living there at any one time. And just before I hand over to you, Phil, we are talking here about potentially thousands of claimants and literally hundreds of millions at risk for the Avara investors and the Avara insurers. We're talking about claimants including swimmers, walkers, canoeists, clubs, anglers, businesses, you know, within leisure and recreation whose lives and trade has been hit. So, I mean, they're talking about potentially a vast number of people, and Lee Day are currently appealing for claimants within a 4,000 square kilometre catchment area.
Yeah, this could be absolutely phenomenal in terms of the precedent that it sets. Yeah, looking at it, there's a real Erin Brockovich vibe about it. So I wonder if there'll be a movie in 10, 15 years time, which tells the story of this case. And what's interesting here from my perspective is that there is precedent for this in terms of taking the supply chain to task, essentially, for the harm that they've caused in a vicinity. Not in the UK context, but in Oklahoma. So there was a court ruled that Cargill were polluting the Illinois River by spreading chicken manure on land, and yeah, pollution and all the, I suppose, public health impacts and economic impacts that were arising as a result of that. And the judge in that case found that Cargill knew or should have known that using poultry waste as fertilizer pose this risk to water quality. So the same argument is being made in a UK context as well. And obviously we've got Avaya Foods, but there's also that link through to Tesco as well, and bigger actors within the supply chain and big multinational supermarkets and things like that as well. So it's just
Tesco specifically, because Avaya are supplying them.
Yeah, that's it. So there's going to be, depending on what the outcome of this is, knock-on impacts all the way through that as well. And I think just generally, we're often kind of seeing that question of who pays, like who is the polluter in this situation? Who pays for that pollution? It's very difficult to, I suppose, in certain cases like this, to pinpoint it on any one actor. But it's interesting, that tack on the supply chain. And yeah, it's a bit new and a bit of a novel way to look at things as well.
And I should say that Avaya Foods has responded. They say that they are committed to playing their part in the restoration of the River Wye by taking accountability for the poultry manure that originates from within its supply chain. But they say that reversing the decline of the river is beyond the means of any single organisation. And I guess this is what it's all about, isn't it? I mean, I'm not sure if there are other examples of this sort of class action style approach. I mean, class action is a term, you know, really associated with the US legal system. But in this context, we're talking about something similar. And if courts find in the claimant's favour, in the favour of the claimants through Lee Day, then the impact of that financially, on investment, on insurers, on the companies, and on the chicken industry itself could be phenomenal. And it could open the floodgates for a whole raft of similar claims in different places, different parts of the industry and associated elements of the industry.
It's huge, and it would have a big impact on investment decisions, because I don't think it's a coincidence that there is such a proliferation of poultry units within one location. There's been a decision made to invest there for whatever reasons, whether that's in terms of efficiency of transport, in terms of conditions, all those sorts of things. There is a reason why there's such a proliferation. And if there is the threat of such action in the future, businesses are going to consider things a lot differently. And also there's probably going to be the knock-on impact that regulators will be looking at things in a different way potentially as well, particularly around planning and the approval of applications for, I suppose, intensive poultry units that in an individual sense probably don't have that much of an impact, but cumulatively over an area, they do.
Yeah, and I mean, we are having this conversation around chicken, but potentially we could be having this conversation around slurry, around a whole range of different elements of dealing with farm waste. So to summarise here, it seems to me that there has been a staggering failure of business to self-regulate in this situation, an enormous failure in the planning system, and an incredible failure by statutory bodies. And it's worth mentioning, of course, that there is a separate claim going in by Lee Day against the Environment Agency for failing to enforce the rules that they have regarding waste management. So watch this space. And I guess this is linked to the second story as well, isn't it? Not least in terms of dealing with risk and regulation and investment.
Indeed. And the next piece is focused on a report which talks about how we can unlock finance for nature in a way which is delivering at the right scale, delivering the right type of benefits. So it makes the point that there's an urgent need for large-scale funding of nature-based solutions across many landscapes. And this is from the perspective of the UK meeting net zero targets, delivering environmental obligations, but also delivering social and health transformations as well. And it talks about the current context and the current landscape. So it makes the point that investment at this stage is largely quite piecemeal, tends to be very focused at a project level, and is kind of scattered rather than kind of connected and integrated across the whole. And it makes this very clear case that we need to see a change in scope if we want to actually see systemic change. And yeah, private finance playing that role. So this report, which is Aggregation and Investment for Nature, it reflects on research undertaken by North Star Transition in 2023. So what this did was discuss through a range of different workshops with a range of different, I suppose, actors within the financial sector to see what they needed in order to invest in nature-based solutions, and importantly, at scale and across a large landscape. And it focused on answering two questions. So what do investors want, and what do the assets that they will invest in look like? And three things kind of came up from this, which were quite important. And that was revenues, costs and risks, the financial structures that were put in place as well. And then also this idea of organizational structure and governance in this piece was particularly interesting because it spoke around the need for well-formed, quite large institutions, but the need for flexibility at a specific landscape or in a specific area as well. So interesting bit of work, which will hopefully inform the next stage of how we actually unlock a lot of private finance to deliver some of these things like biodiversity net gain, nutrient neutrality, all these sorts of things that are in the pipeline.
Indeed, thanks. And this article report focuses on unlocking finance for nature is, of course, linked to an 8.9 TV video interview that I did with Vicky van der Stickel, who was an author on the report. The video interview is titled North Star Transition Focuses on Unlocking Finance for Nature, and that's still on the homepage at 8.9.com. And what she was talking about there, it was two things that really came out of that interview for me, and you've touched on them already, but the need for partnerships in order to be able to deliver at a landscape scale. And so what they were talking about needing was having very practical, localized bodies, localized groups who had that connection with the land, but they needed to work in partnership really with quite big, large scale, perhaps corporate investors. And getting those two to link up together was quite difficult. And what she was saying was that, you know, if we're just talking about a few hundreds of thousands, that just isn't enough to make those financial investment institutions interested. We need to be talking in terms of millions or much bigger, which is why then aggregating from individual farms or individual businesses up to that landscape scale is so important.
That's absolutely crucial. And I suppose this is the real challenge in making this work, because most farm businesses are small and medium-sized enterprises. The average size of the UK farm is probably about 80 hectares or so. So to actually deliver the level of return that investors want to see definitely needs that aggregated approach. And I think we do have good examples of farm cluster groups, of group agri-environment schemes, where a facilitator is able to bring a large number of farmers together. And we are starting to see from certain organisations making that work in terms of leveraging private finance as well. So we've seen the likes of the River Trust working in the Wyre catchment. They've developed a very interesting model which actually has managed to bring a range of different farmers together while working with investors who have the capital to make it work for both sides.
That's interesting. Actually, just while you say that, it reminds me that the Scottish government at the moment is looking at land reform again and is talking about any land holdings over 1,000 hectares, having a commissioner sort of call that in so that they can take decisions about whether that land holding should be broken up and sold in smaller parts. And of course, if we're talking about trying to mobilise investment into these very large land holdings, perhaps 600,000 and more acres that exist up in the Scottish Highlands, then maybe that isn't the best approach, that actually you need to have this ability to unlock natural capital opportunities on these very large landholdings in order to get that investment in place. And that maybe, therefore, this isn't the best time to be talking about breaking things up at just the time that we need to be delivering this, you know, this really big landscape scale change in a really swift, accelerated manner. The other thing that I wanted to pick up on, Phil, from what Vicky van der Stickel was talking about, was the areas of investment risk. And what she said was that there were three areas of risk in particular. One was around the construction, the operational risks of any particular project. Then secondly, there was the reputational risks, and then there were regulatory risks. And I think in terms of those construction risks, there's a degree to which those are within the company's control. They're experience-led. The more they do it, the better they'll get at it and better at understanding those costs. Then you've got the reputational risks. Again, to an extent, these are within company control, but they also rely on having robust and resilient frameworks, really strong, credible verification mechanisms. And these reputational risks, you know, that companies are also vulnerable to changes in public demands and expectations as they go forward. So the durability of those credits is really essential. But then we come to the regulatory risks, and I think that really is a big challenge. We know, you and I, and many of the the people listening that government action in the UK, whether in England, Wales, Northern Ireland or Scotland, it isn't fully joined up, even in a single nation or a single part of a nation like the UK. And so changes in national, international policy, scientific developments as we move forward, these all create uncertainty.
They do. And also, I suppose, the political landscape in which we're operating at the moment as well. And a lot of these markets have come to light or come to being in an era where we're very much focused on the road towards net zero and in recognising the need to create, I suppose, nature positive societies as well. And there's been a general level of political consensus across most nations of that pathway. And that is something now, I think, is at real risk of being undermined, of being eroded. And what does that mean for that, that regulatory environment and that certainty for investors as well? Because it is quite worrying. And it's difficult because it's not something that you have direct control or influence over. So you're a little bit left, not to the gods, so to speak, but there is an element of loss of control within that as well.
And just before we move on to the next item, I just wanted to mention the Environmental Audit Committee, which met in Westminster this week, looking at standards, because this is sort of talking about the credibility and the durability of these credits and the resilience of this market with clear frameworks. And we had Dr. Scott Stedman, who's the Director General of Standards at the British Standards Institute, who agreed under questioning at the EAC by Labour MP Barry Gardiner that perhaps a Chief Secretary for Natural Capital might be needed in order to create the consistency and credibility that's needed in this space. So again, if there's a question mark over whether the market should be regulating itself and the point at which government should be stepping in and ensuring that regulation itself and where you get the balance there. Shall we move on to the final story before we meet Rob?
Yes, we will. So the next story is focused on updated carbon offsetting principles, which aim to combat greenwashing. So this is a set of new principles or updated principles that have been developed by an interdisciplinary team of Oxford University researchers, which are trying to develop guidance which provides, I suppose, a credible pathway towards net zero, the role of carbon offsetting within that, and to kind of guide the market and guide projects and investment and things like that as well. So the revised Oxford offsetting principles provide clarifications to this original text, and it's based on the latest evidence and science. And essentially what they're calling for is a major course correction in carbon market offsets or carbon offsetting markets and current practices. And they also outline how offsetting needs to be approached in the future to actually help deliver a net zero society. So there's a few quotes here, which I think are quite pertinent.
And just before you do, the point is that the Oxford offsetting principles, you know, they've been around for, you know, several years now. And the feeling is from the people who've been setting them that they've been misused, I think.
Yeah. They've been in place since 2020. And there is a lot of, I suppose, cynicism and scepticism that they've been applied effectively. And yeah, essentially, a lot of commentators are saying that offset markets aren't actually fit for purpose, and they're serving to undermine confidence in their role to deliver net zero, as opposed to building confidence itself. So a few of those quotes kind of point to that. But we'll start with the principles first, actually. So the first one, cutting emissions is a priority and ensuring the environmental integrity of credits. So making sure that they're actually robust and fit for purpose. So first of all, cut emissions before you offset. Transition to carbon removal offsetting for any residual emissions. And this is moving away from emissions avoidance or reduction. And this needs to be done by the net zero target date to actually meet net zero. Shift to removals with durable storage and low risk of reversal. And then support the development of innovative and integrated approaches to achieving net zero.
And in terms of that durable storage, I mean, we've talked about this before, but really, I guess we're talking about timber and soil and fast-growing fibres like hemp, which can then be, you know, transformed. And having got the carbon into the trees, you then cut them down and lock them in and use them for building materials and so on. And this just demonstrates how important it is, actually, to start building a credible and consistent soil carbon code so that soil can be part of that story.
Indeed. So that needs to actually ensure that your stores are, in the long term, if not permanent. And I think these are trying to address some of the challenges that the authors of the report that have mentioned. So Injai Johnson, who's the research associate at the Oxford Sustainable Finance Group within the Smith School of Enterprise and the Environment, has said that the vast majority of current offsetting approaches are not getting us any closer to net zero emissions. And trust in the concept of offsetting has been so badly damaged that some organisations are moving away from using the term at all. So I think the intention is that these principles help to avoid and mitigate against that and bring us back onto, I suppose, a better pathway with something that could deliver some good but has been not used in the right way until now.
And I think as well there was an aspect within this that they were looking at ways of actually delivering nature-based solutions that help to connect the drawdown with biodiversity improvements rather than having carbon sequestration and storage that actually diminish the ability to regenerate the biodiversity as well.
And that's going to be absolutely crucial. And yeah, we've seen in the past or in the present as well that nature is often the ugly sister compared to climate, and you can get a lot of stuff wrong if you're not looking at those holistically.
Phil, thanks so much. Let's take a break. And we're back, and we're joined by Rob York, who goes by the Twitter handle of @blackgull. He is well known for his vlogs on Twitter on land use and environmental issues generally, and he is a self-styled environmental diplomat. So maybe, Rob, hello, start off by telling us, what is that? What's an environmental diplomat?
An environmental diplomat is someone who has been in the game for a very long time. They've got a very long memory about what people have said over the years, if not, say, decades. It's someone who's maybe at the interface of research and academics and practitioners and farmers and foresters. It's someone who's trying to carve out space in order to have some of these conversations. And I think the role of diplomacy within environmental issues is something that hasn't really been explored because we all want transparency. We want it out in the open. But there's a big role for something known as track two diplomacy, where you build trust. And some of it's behind the scenes to build up relationships between people who may have different values but common purpose. And it's a very contested world out there, as you know.
Now, Rob, I want to drill into this idea of diplomacy just a little bit, because diplomacy for me, having worked, you know, in and around governments, you know, over the course of my life, is that diplomacy is very much about achieving predetermined outcomes at a governmental level, often in the interest of those single parties. So you have diplomats from the UK discussing or arguing with diplomats from another country. Often this is done with a promise of funding or trade contracts or perhaps arms sales. You're talking about something different, and it feels to me that it's not so much diplomacy as trying to sort of build consensus, but knock me back, tell me I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to be a little bit undiplomatic and knock you back a little bit by saying that it's, which in a way you've identified, it's not true diplomacy, it is in that you're trying to push a position. It's very much about trying to move away from a positional statement. So you're trying to bring something to the table to push it forward, more about a principle to negotiation, which is where you're finding out who's in the room to start with. And I think that's a really important thing that we don't tend to do these days. We come into the room, we don't listen, we just transmit. And so the kind of diplomacy that I'm interested in is garnering diverse range of opinions in order to then build more resilience. Now, I'm just going to quickly point you to a tiny paragraph which popped up from the IPCC report. And right at the bottom of paragraph 1052, at the bottom of the paragraph was, diverse range of views ensures better long-term resilience. And for me, that's the objective.
I was just going to come in on that as well, Rob, in terms of the current landscape that we have. And yeah, everything's very heavily contested. It's very, very polarized. And it's very, very binary, I think, in terms of the arguments that are being put forward. So from your perspective, compared to, say, 5-10 years ago, is there a need for more diplomacy in this space than there was?
I mean, Phil, I mean, yes. I mean, I'm going to say yes, but I don't think it's as obvious as trying to reach the people that are perhaps speaking right at the minute. I think it's more about the silent majority. And that's why I love doing what I'm doing, which is also curating and moderating conferences and events to move the microphone around and get it away from sometimes the usual voices, and they're all valid, very important to hear from their different range of voices, but to kind of read the room, read the air, is the Japanese expression, to see someone twitching and say, right, get a microphone over there. And then you say, ah, the room then hears a point of view which they hadn't heard beforehand. So you're right, Phil. It's such a contested area. So we have to be a little more creative, and dare I even going to use the word cunning, in order to carve out that space, to sometimes bring people to the table who need to be there, who aren't always the same as those that want to be there. Yeah. Now, that obviously can make you unpopular.
And we've got one example of that recently, which I suppose indicates that the various different voices all shouting at each other, and then that silent majority potentially within it, is this, I suppose, forest versus farming debate, and particularly the situation that we've seen in Wales, which has become heavily and highly contested. And I've understood, or I've been told, kind of listening in from a distance, that the voices that are in the airwaves don't necessarily always reflect the kind of perception on the ground or the level of understanding. And my question is, do you see a similar trend across the board?
Well, I think that it's very easy to start a baseline from today without being aware of the backstory. So in that context of Wales, you know, in 1970, when the UK joined the EU, EEC then, there was a lot of antagonism coming from some of the Welsh farmers. They were right up there in the middle of London throwing eggs at, you know, the minister. So that backstory, which then if you wind forward to CAP, the Common Agricultural Policy, the modulation of taking the funds from Pillar 1 and moving it across to Pillar 2 in Wales, they did the full 15%, and they said, yeah, don't worry. The Welsh government said to the farmers, don't worry, you will get it back in the rural development payments. Now, it kind of didn't happen that way. You know, there's lots of pressures on funding. Once it disappears, it tends not to come back. And so those backstories are very important. That lack of trust between government and, I won't just say farmers, I'm going to say forestry. I'm going to use the wider term. And of course, people don't even like me using the wider term land managers, but that covers the wider diversity of what we're talking about across the land use of Wales. And so farmers don't have the trust to be able to be in the room with government to have some of these discussions.
And you mentioned being in the room. And I suppose we've just come out of a long period of engagement online. And you mentioned about those voices and the microphone being handed. And that's very difficult to do whenever everyone and it was only a certain number of actors are online. So does that fit into this as well?
Well, yeah, strongly. And that then, I'm going to flip back across to England, you know, the start of Health and Harmony, the Agricultural Act, and then the co-design of the new farming support payments, too often they're still referred to as subsidies, and they're not subsidies. And a lot of that early stuff was done during COVID. And of course, it had to be. There was no choice in the matter, but it meant it was all online. So only those farmers, land managers who were keen to embrace Zoom and Teams and that little eye at the top of the computer, they were the ones in the room. And so you weren't hearing from a large swathe of voices who possibly you might be hearing from now, but a little bit late. Now, that's not their fault, but it's how we communicate. And I personally, in my new role as a kind of, I love moderating, but I would turn down work if it was online. If someone said, here's £1 million, could you do 500 people on a screen and talk about tensions between land use, farming, forestry and wildlife management of curlews and silage making with forestry conifer plantations online. I'd say no thanks. I'd do that in a room. Even better, I would do it on a walk and talk, and you can use all kinds of creative technology to ensure that you can have that robust debate. And I think we've lost that ability to have robust dialogue and not get offended. You know, we can be robust but respectful. And I think we lack tolerance of these other narratives. And that brings me back to your point. You know, it's not farming or trees. It's farming and trees within the landscape. And that brings me back, you know, to the Welsh government briefly. The 10% tree communication was pretty terrible because they didn't they didn't read the room as to get the wording right, as to bring people into it. Of course, you can't make everyone happy the whole time. And I think we've got to be braver on to have some of these brave, have these explicit conversations about the trade-offs. And there are trade-offs, you know.
Yeah, offence is also important, Rob, isn't it? I think, you know, sometimes you say, you know, without people taking offence, but being able to be respectful. I think sometimes offence is part of a process and you need to be able to go away and come back and have a chat through it. It's very hard to imagine, you know, the Northern Ireland agreement being signed if it was just a series of Zoom meetings.
Yeah.
You know, it's about being able to go away over a cup of coffee and have a chat and realise that you're not the only one in the room that's thinking something that other people are too, and then come back with that knowledge. Or to go away and have a longer conversation and to recalibrate those positions. And it always strikes me that diplomacy is very much sort of built on the Adam Smith principles of mutual self-interest. And it seems, you know, whether we're talking at an international level or whether we're talking in terms of Wales, we need to respect the fact that everybody has an interest. Sometimes those interests are widely divergent, but at the same time, there are common positions which can be accepted, even if not everybody's, you know, happy and dancing about it, that are acceptable.
I would say that there's no harm in being offended. It's how you then, as you say, how you react to being offended. Do you then try and find a new space to kind of work on those tough issues together? And quite often, I think about the Northern Ireland Accord in that there are some direct parallels as to how to move something forward, because the background to the peace accord was that they contacted the British government, the Irish. Well, let's not go down that rabbit hole kind of too much, but there was quite a lot of diplomacy behind the scenes before the public face-to-face diplomacy. So I think we can do a lot of work behind the scenes. And okay, so for example, the Welsh government could have worked behind the scenes between some of the interested parties. I'm not so keen on the word stakeholders, because by holding a stake, you're holding a position, more about interested parties. And so you can see where the tensions are before you then go public. You red team it, you look at it from all the angles, and then you become more equipped before you arrive at the press release. And I'm seeing quite a lot of this, that people are more keen to rush forward than to kind of do a bit of peer review and to work out how this is going to run, you know, before it goes out into the public domain. I mean, I was hosting some discussions at a countryside fair, let's call it that. And in one tent, I had a water company, I had fishing interests and farmers. And you know what? It wasn't the bun fight that the media probably wanted. And that's because I think we can frame things so that we don't always have to have the fight. Of course, we can. There's nothing wrong with having the fight. It's just how to avoid a knife fight in a phone box, as a government official said the other day during the conference.
There's a question with this as well, because just on that point around the inside track work and building consensus behind the scenes. And we've used the example of the situation in Wales. We've also got a situation in England where there's still quite fervent debate on things and disagreement. I don't know if you agree if there's a balancing act to play, or a tension between trying to get areas of common ground and alignment and shared vision versus the need to act quite quickly on a lot of this stuff as well, and where that comes in, and how do you effectively address
before
those?
You answer that, Rob, can I just throw in an extra one, which is, you've sometimes talked about the role of language and whether you should call something wildlife friendly or wildflower friendly or nature friendly farming. How does that fit into to what Phil was asking about there?
Yeah, I'm trying to maintain two thoughts in my head at the same time, even if they're totally conflicting. It's finding the consensus. I mean, and it may not always be the consensus people want. It may be, I would argue that sometimes we need to find our way around gatekeepers. There's quite a lot of gatekeeping. So what I mean by gatekeeping is that people have had these conversations and they are the spokesperson for that subject. And they sometimes are the ones who might block the consensus. And so you have to be delicate as to listen to them, but then to kind of move around the side to pick out people who can help move stuff forward. I spend a lot of time in conferences with academics, and then I spend other time in other conferences with farmers, foresters, practitioners, rewilders, whatever. And I sometimes think, my goodness, if they could be in that room, they could be in that room, we might learn a lot more. And the semantics do matter. You're absolutely right on that one, Philip, because... And I'm probably quite a pedant. You know, when we say nature friendly, something. I'd like to define what the nature is. Otherwise, we're just going to lead ourselves down this valley of saying we can have it all. We can have nature-friendly food and farming, but actually we don't want aphids, but we want beetles. We don't want worms in our livestock because that's not very good for welfare, but we want dung flies because that's good for kind of pollination.
In that sense, just to come in on that, is that that's the question, I suppose, from our perspective as the Nature Friendly Farming Network, we use that term quite a lot. It's that relationship between nature being an ally to supporting food production or supporting more sustainable and resilient businesses. And yeah, I think you're completely right how that relationship works, what type of nature you want to see in a specific landscape, for example, or for your system, I think is really, really key and really important.
Yeah, I mean, you know, okay, so just on that one, quite a few years ago, I was chairing a conference. I suddenly asked to chair it. It was all about pollinators. It was run by an environmental organization. So Jeffrey were there, and wildlife scientists, all that, bees and pollinators and agrochemical people were there. And I said, you know what, before the MP leaves, I want all of you to take your labels off and to give me 60 seconds on what you know and love about pollinators, not just bees. And so we can all learn from what you know, rather than, and do not mention it, for whom you work. And so the relief was palpable. So we could discover all that stuff about the pollinators in different places, you know, from the view of those people trying to produce food at the same time you're having to reduce some of the wrong insects in the wrong place. You know, there is the ability to kind of tease out more common ground. But I mean, you know, a lot of people might say I'm a bit naive by saying there is so much common ground out there. It's hard work to win it. But I do think there's more opportunity to do it than we give ourselves credit for. COP15 was all about biodiversity, but actually target 10 was all about agriculture. No one's talked about that at all. We all talk about 30 by 30 areas managed for nature. Other people say, no, hang on, it's 30 by 30 areas protected for nature. Well, actually, managed, unprotected areas for nature are very successful. But that takes the narrative away from those people that want to just slap a designated protection over it. And then that disenfranchises those people who want to, as farmers and land managers and agrochemical people that want to do more work for nature at the same time. So I'm a little bit disruptive because I want to disrupt some of the agitators who possibly want to keep the room full of a campaign, whereas I want to move into the new space, take people with us, and that means everybody. It's not just the people that agree, and keep refining on what we can do to find, you know, the common purpose or where the big blockers are. We're not learning enough from what goes wrong. And I think that's just as valuable. Langham Moore Partnership, I was involved with that, which is a kind of partnership between the RSPB and the Gate Conservancy and Natural England and the Scottish National Heritage, as it was then, and the landowner. There were a lot of things that went wrong, but there was a lot of stuff to learn from it. Anyway.
Rob, we've run out of time, and it's been such a joy to talk to you, and hopefully we can have a longer conversation at some point, perhaps on the Farmgate podcast or something like that. But for now, Rob York, thanks so much. Let's take a break. And we're back, and thanks again to Rob York for that. And I guess, Phil, what it comes down to, this whole idea of environmental diplomacy and being able to have those conversations, is to an extent what the organisations that are hosting an event are actually trying to get out of it, whether they're trying to genuinely have a conversation where they listen and where new ideas and consensus can be found, or whether really the purpose of that event is to lead the conversation in a particular direction.
Yeah, and that's a very, very important distinction within all of this. And I think it's a fair enough challenge that sometimes they go towards the latter rather than the former quite often. So I think, yeah, food for thought within that.
Look, we're going to move on to this final section, which is largely about policy. And we've got sort of three stories essentially to take us through it. But different policy elements coming out of the UK in the last week or two. And the first is from Wales.
Yes, we keep coming back to Wales, and that's not a bad thing at all. But we've seen quite seismic developments in Wales over the last couple of weeks. And first of all, we've seen a new First Minister coming into post. So we've seen Vaughan Gething as the new First Minister for Wales, obviously replacing Mark Drakeford, who was in there for quite a considerable period of time. And with that, he has brought a reshuffle of people, but there's also been some quite seismic departmental moves as well. So we've seen a new Cabinet Secretary for the Department of Climate Change and Rural Affairs, which is a new combined ministry, which is really
interesting.
And that's
really important, isn't it? Because it's really making the point that climate change and agriculture are intrinsically linked.
Yeah, it really strongly brings those two together and demonstrates that in a Welsh context, agriculture has, well, I suppose in UK context, agriculture has an absolutely fundamental role to play in addressing climate change, not just from a mitigation perspective, but also adaptation as well. So it's really, really interesting to see this new department being brought in and recognising the importance of that.
And who's the new Cabinet Secretary?
Yes, so the new Cabinet Secretary is Hugh Aranka-Davies, who comes to the role with a wealth of experience, having previously served as a shadow minister in Westminster government. So he should have a good understanding of the brief. It'll be interesting to see what he does with it, especially after such debate on the future of agriculture policy in Wales recently.
What it seems to me is that this is a golden opportunity for Wales and farmers within Wales who have been upset by what's been proposed with the sustainable farming scheme, just to take a breath and to reset that conversation before the government then, you know, takes... listens and looks at all the responses to that consultation and comes up with its final proposals.
Definitely. And I think it'll be interesting to see what changes potentially in that the role of the Welsh government and particularly this department in communicating that change. And we spoke about that previously with Rob in terms of some of the fear and trepidation isn't based on the realities necessarily of the scheme, but the understanding of what, or misunderstanding of what the scheme will do. And I think there is an element of that within this too. So we might see some change on that front.
And again, in terms of diplomacy and that notion of environmental diplomacy, rural diplomacy, you know, sometimes you've got to a point where that conversation, where those where that distrust has spiraled to the extent where it can only be navigated by a change in who it is that's driving it. And if we think back to Northern Ireland, you know, having Labour come in at that particular point as a new government and Mo Molum going in there as a personality, as a quite a disruptive personality, made all the difference. And, you know, the hope is, I guess, here that Hugh Aranka-Davies can really make the difference at this juncture in Wales.
Yeah, and it just shows how much of an influence or a difference one individual can make in particular positions. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how Hugh makes his go.
Moving from Wales, we've got the Environmental Audit Committee asking, where is the land use framework?
And that is a good question, because the land use framework was due to be published in 2023 with a commitment from government when providing oral evidence to the committee itself. But there has been no indication that it'd be obviously we've missed that deadline. It's now been given an unspecified date in 2024. So it could be spring, could be summer, could be autumn. We're not entirely sure. But the EAC have made it very, very clear that a land use framework is absolutely crucial in informing, I suppose, multifunctional land use and land use which delivers an optimal kind of, delivers optimal benefits in the right places. And this would be in a way to try and address potential trade-offs between food production, climate mitigation, nature restoration, but also trying to integrate them in effective ways as well. So, the EAC has come out with quite disappointed tones in the fact that we haven't seen the land use framework. It also has made some points there in relation to food security and the fact that food security hasn't been recognised by government as a public good, which is one we can, I suppose, discuss, but also talks about Rishi Sunak's recent announcement in putting forward proposals for a food security index, which I suppose is a little bit of an attempt at recognising that food security in a way would be measured by state.
And that brings us back, doesn't it, to that whole conversation about what constitutes a public good. And over the last few years, there has been this idea that public goods are things that the market can't pay for. And of course, the market does pay for food. But the challenge is that the external costs of food production have become so high over the last few decades because of the way that government and contracts have directed farmers to farm, that there is a real need to kind of think of food production in public good terms, because it's going to need to be funded by the public and funded by the market if we're going to reset something which is genuinely sustainable.
Yeah, I think what happens quite often within this debate is we look at food security, or we talk about the need to improve food security, or talk about the risks to food security, and we conflate that with food production and self-sufficiency. And while self-sufficiency is a contributor or an important part of food security, it by no means is the be-all and end-all. And whenever you look at the facts and figures, the UK is pretty self-sufficient in most staple products that we can produce here. There's definitely scope to increase production of certain products, and that's specifically fruit and vegetables, but mainly for grains and meat production, where we're self-sufficient or close to it in many areas. So I think there's a risk.
But if we're looking to the future around climate disruption and resilience in that sort of environment,
yeah,
where trade becomes much more difficult, then there is a need, isn't there, to lock in the food security that we have at the level that we have it currently, but then to build that capacity going forward.
Indeed. And the question is, what do you do to do that? And we've seen this big debate around Elms and its how it undermines or risks undermining food security. But whenever you're looking at food security and from the perspective of that climate risk and that global disruption, it actually makes sense and makes the point that, yeah, investment, environmental land management is a crucial component and a crucial part of food security. And I think sometimes we're missing the trick a little bit whenever we're having these simple binary trade-off arguments as we were talking about earlier. And again, food security at a household level, it's affected by so much more than what we produce at home. There's dietary choices within that, there's incomes, there's all sorts of things. And those never really get pulled out in a way which is coherent within this argument, I think.
And of course, one of the foundations of food security is soil health. And so we have this other article, this time coming out of the EFRA committee, talking about the way in which questions remain over England's plan for improving soil health. The committee have welcomed the government's response to a report that they put out a few months ago, welcoming recognition of soil as an important asset and the increase in the sustainable farming incentive payment rates for improved soil health. But they have criticised the vagueness and the failure to prioritise soil health, in particular alongside water and air quality. And if I just read out this quote from the article, this is from the Soil Association, Gareth Morgan, who's the head of farming policy. He says, "We depend on soil for almost all of our food production, and the EFRA committee rightly warns that soil is vital for all life on Earth. This is why the Soil Association," he says, "and others have sought to amend the Environment Act so that soil is given the same protection as water, air and nature. It's alarming that the government has ignored this advice from the EFRA inquiry and failed to act on many recommendations, including the call to better regulate harmful practices. With millions of hectares of UK soil at risk," they say, "the target to bring 60% of soils under sustainable management is simply insufficient. We cannot leave almost half of this vital resource at risk. We need nature-friendly, agroecological and organic farming, and I would add regenerative farming and these various other terms that we started discussing with Rob, across all of our farmland if we're going to achieve EFRA's recommendation of 90% of soils being managed sustainably."
I couldn't agree more. And I think, again, that link between what EAC are calling for, the Environment Audit Committee, and what EFRA are calling for, there's a clear link between the two of them. There's a need to join those up. And yeah, whilst there are some positive commitments within that, it's generally a re-articulation of what's already been committed to in the past. There's nothing new in there. And I think, yeah, that need to develop holistic regulations that protect soils properly and don't have them in this kind of disparate situation that we have at the moment, where you have various different pieces of regulation which kind of protect soils but don't really do it in the round. I think we need to kind of go back to the drawing board and build something a lot better and really recognise the importance of soils for food security, for farm business resilience, for everything else.
It's very much sort of B minus, C plus territory, isn't it? A long way to go before we get to A star. Look, there's one final thing that I thought that we should talk about just before we wrap it up for today, and this is that the government has announced that it will cap the land area that can be used on a single farm for delivery of 6 SFI payments. Could you take us through those, Phil?
Yes, so this is a step by definition that's been taken to put limits on a number of actions within the current SFI offer, because there were fears that farmers were going to be putting quite considerable portions of their farm into these actions. thereby potentially impacting food security if this was delivered at a massive scale. But also there's questions there around value for money as well, in terms of what is the actual environmental benefit of putting a whole food or a whole farm into wild birdseed mix, for example. And yeah, there's six actions that have gotten now a cap of 25%. So 25% of the farm holding can be put into these actions from now on, rather than anything more. There's a flower-rich grass margins, pollen nectar flower mix, winter bird feed, grassy field corners, improved grass and field corners or blocks out of management, and winter bird food on improved grassland. And this comes off the back of I suppose, quite a lot of loud calls to say that Elms, and SFI in particular, is going to have a negative impact on food production. What I would caveat this with is the fact that it's about 1% of current applicants that have actually taken such action and put such large proportions of their farm into actions like these. There's quite a lot of farm businesses that are actually delivering relatively little in terms of action. So it's the baselining activities and sort of in terms of soil assessments, in terms of integrated pest management plans. And there's a question there about the need for a scheme that actually blocks things in together, has a minimum threshold, but also has a certain level of capping on certain options too. So they're actually getting a minimum level of environmental delivery across a landscape. And then that's generally whenever you start to see the economic benefits starting to cascade from there too.
Phil, thanks so much. We're out of time, so it just remains for me to say thank you once again to Rob York for joining us. And if you're on Twitter and you haven't yet come across his vlogs, he's worth checking out. And he quite regularly updates with just little minute segments of his thought for the day. At Black Gull is where you can find Rob York. And of course, Phil, babies can come at any time, they come in their own time. So I just want to wish you and your partner the absolute best of luck if that baby comes before we speak again.
Thanks, Finlow. Here's hoping that she doesn't, because I've got a lot of stuff that I need to get sorted out beforehand. But thank you so much for that.
Well, I think the workload suddenly just goes down the plug hole once that baby comes. But there we go. Anyway, best of luck. And I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.
And I've been Phil Carson. Goodbye.